Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, as well as the Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, April 15th, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is a Courthouse Steps oral argument discussion on Iancu v. Brunetti. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today we are very fortunate to have with us Mr. Ilya Shapiro, who is Director of the Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute. After our speaker gives his remarks today, we will move to an audience Q&A, so please keep in mind what questions you have for our speaker or for the case. Thank you very much for sharing with us today, Ilya. The floor is yours.
Great. Well, thanks very much. It was an interesting argument that didn't go quite the way I think a lot of people expected, not in terms of who's going to win, but in what the focus would be. Going into the argument, and I should say that I filed a brief on behalf of not just Cato, but also P.J. O'Rourke, Nadine Strossen, the DKT Liberty Project, and other scandalous individuals and organizations. This was one of Cato's periodic funny briefs, although I guess this one is more of a vulgar one. But anyway, our expectation, I think the conventional wisdom, is that it would all be about, can we distinguish this case from Tam? Because isn't scandal, you know, if the government isn't capable or shouldn't be the one determining what offensive or disparaging is, that is from that case 2 years ago where they struck down restrictions on trademarks that were offensive or disparaging to certain people or groups, then what is scandalous or immoral? That seems like more very broad things that the analysis works the same way. But that did not turn out to be the focus so much. It was more about, well, Tam was about viewpoint, even if racist viewpoint or what have you, and here is about content and specifically modes of expression. And in the trademark realm, the government is allowed to look at content of various kinds, flags or names of people, or indeed whether there's a likelihood of confusion. That's a judgment call involving the content of the applied for mark. So similarly here, the case was brought or involves an attempt to register the F-U-C-T pronounced fucked, just like, you know, you might have just thought that I was pronouncing a swear word. Not so. I was pronouncing this brand that was trying to be registered. And so, as I said, it was a different sort of focus. The actual profanity or vulgarity was not used. None of George Carlin's seven dirty words were used, although the late comedian's formulation was invoked several times. The lawyer for the government, Malcolm Stewart, who, by the way, was the same lawyer who argued the first argument in Citizens United, and I'll tell you why that is relevant in a moment, described the scandalous homonym here as the, quote, past participle of paradigmatic profanity. I don't know whether he meant to alliterate. It was a kind of a catchy way of speaking around the word. At the very end, Chief Justice Roberts asked whether the word, and he spelled out F-U-C-K, could be registered as a trademark. So that's the closest that anyone came to actually using the seven dirty word, if you will. So to go back to the beginning, the government's argument, Malcolm Stewart, the deputy SG, began talking about how this is not a restriction on speech. The brand can continue using its FUCT logo trademark. It just can't register it because this is a regulation of a federal program. You're registering to participate in a federal program. The government doesn't want to include these sorts of things associated with certain kinds of words. Well, Justice Sotomayor asks, how do you define scandalous? And the response is, well, something that's offensive or shocking because of the mode of expression. And then Justice Sotomayor says, well, that seems to run headlong into Tam. That is, you know, what's this is a subjective test of what's offensive or shocking to some people. And Justice Ginsburg jumped on and said, how is that determined? Well, Stewart said, it's perceived by a significant part of the population. Well, Sotomayor said, then, again, this is subjective. Why not just say something that's obscene or profane or vulgar? And Kagan asked, what are we supposed to be doing here? Are you asking us to rewrite the statute to make it narrower? Are you asking us to follow some Federal Circuit precedent that's already narrowed the application? Are you simply asking us to trust you and your promises that you're not going to apply it broadly to what Tam said you can't? And that's where that got me thinking to Citizens United, because at a prophetic circumstance in that argument, the first time it was argued, the government kept saying, well, we would never prosecute a book publisher just for putting, you know, vote Hillary Clinton or vote against Hillary Clinton at the very end of their 300-page book. And John Roberts jumps in, really, we're supposed to just trust you for that. We're supposed to trust our First Amendment rights to the noblesse oblige of prosecutors and bureaucrats. And so, you know, same lawyer, kind of a curious thing. And then, of course, Justice Kagan, when she was Solicitor General, argued the re-argument in Citizens United. But anyway, here Malcolm Stewart replied that the government is asking the court to apply constitutional avoidance, that is, to interpret the statute in a way that the court would not have to strike down this particular provision. And so he kept going back to obscenity and vulgarity, these sorts of things, which, at least on the obscenity side, Mr. Sommer, Brunetti's lawyer, ended up saying that the government doesn't need this provision to not register obscenity, because obscenity can already be illegal. And there's another provision in the Lanham Act that says that you can't do things you can't have marks that are illegal for some way. John Roberts, the Chief Justice, then introduces an interesting discussion about whether, after all, since this is a facial challenge, he asked the government's lawyer, why did you spend seemingly most of your time in the brief arguing from general propositions rather than simply saying, look, with a facial challenge, the side bringing the challenge has to say that there are essentially no circumstances where it's lawful or constitutional for this law to be applied. And here there seems to be agreement that obscenities can be restricted, certain other things. So, you know, maybe this brand wins, but we don't have to strike down the statute. I didn't say that explicitly, but you could see that is potentially one way that the court resolves this case. And curiously, when Chief Justice Roberts asks, if you lose this case, could you still deny obscene marks? And the government's lawyer said no, although there's disagreement on that from Mr. Brunetti's lawyer. Justice Alito, when he jumped in, asked about what the standard should be, or what's Congress's interest in regulating this area or making these kinds of restrictions. The answer there is to protect unwilling viewers from seeing things that might, again, shock or scandalize them in some way. But Alito says words can be used. This is just about registration, right? You've argued that registration is a federal program and that you're not being a censor. Well, if words can be used, then these people are going to be using them and viewers are unwittingly going to be seeing these things. But the Deputy SG replied, the government still can attempt to disincentivize, or we're talking about commercial relations here. Trademark registration does facilitate the getting out of your commercial message, and so if registration is denied, sure, these people can still use their brand, but it won't be as widespread, and that goes towards the government interest. Justice Kavanaugh got in to ask about how the court's supposed to deal with the seemingly erratic and unprincipled enforcement of this provision. That is, just as with TAM, with the disparaging trademark provision, there's a whole list of trademarks or trademark applications, some of which have been accepted, some of which were rejected, that Brunetti's counsel put into his brief, and yet there's no rhyme or reason. So either this is overbroad, or anyway, explain yourself. The Deputy SG says, well, all of this has been limited by TAM, and the government does get more leeway when it's not prohibiting speech, when it's not acting as a censor. It's just saying, again, this federal program. So then Justice Kagan goes back to her point. So you're asking us to narrow this statute based on your commitment to follow our previous ruling. So again, the court, you're asking us to rewrite the statute here. She clearly was troubled throughout the whole argument about having to explain what the government's position actually should be and recodifying the standard. Justice Gorsuch speaks for the first time at this point, picking up on the point about many similar marks being granted or rejected. couldn't see a rational line through a chart that was provided in Brunetti's brief. Justice Breyer, I haven't mentioned yet, he raised an interesting line of questions about the dirty words. This is when George Carlin starts figuring in, starts talking about racial slurs and what about certain kinds of words that evoke a physiological effect. That is, you can measure, I guess, people's heart rates or their skin conductivity or these very scientific measures that they're simply affected in a certain way by certain slurs, and perhaps even the most prominent or most negative, most historically charged racial slur, he doesn't name it, nobody does, that could be even worse than any of George Carlin's seven dirty words. So what goes on there? Later on, we learn, by the way, that in the rebuttal, in fact, of the deputy SG, he notes that the Patent and Trademark Office, with respect to that particular heavy racial slur, that it's the PTO's actions are being held in abeyance pending the result of this case, because that particular word is being thought of as potentially both scandalous and not just offensive, although for other things, other kinds of racial slurs, Stewart said, the WSG said, that the PTO is indeed registering them after TAM. Then Chief Justice Roberts says, well, what about the argument that being edgy or nonconformist is itself a message or a viewpoint that we shouldn't be getting in the middle of? It's where, for the first time, a hypothetical that I think really is useful for understanding this case came up when Malcolm Stewart used the example of bus advertising. That is, in effect, striking down this statute would put into jeopardy time, place, and manner restrictions. I was sort of puzzled by that, just my editorial comment. I think the bus example is all you need here, in the sense that it's a different question about whether the PTO should have to register trademarks that come short of obscenity, and obscenity, as comes out later in the argument, is generally pictures or sentences, right? Erotic literature, what have you, could rise to the obscene, rather than single words, right? That's vulgarity, or it's whatever it is. It's not obscenity, generally speaking. But whether a trademark is registered or unregistered, it can still be properly subject to time, place, and manner restrictions, limited public forum analysis, like the side of the bus or a municipal park bench or any of these other things, or, you know, even a perfectly clean, non-vulgar trademark, you know, can't be shouted in the middle of a residential street in the middle of the night, right? So similarly here, the difference between the question is different about whether you can expose sensitive populations to certain messages, how to regulate those things, versus whether the PTO should have to register them or not. We'll see if that hypothetical or something similar is ultimately what turns the court or any of its votes. So it's appropriately, after that discussion of that bus advertising, the government ends its argument with Justice Sotomayor talking about, isn't this akin to a limited public forum, or TAM says that this is different than a normal government program because you're paying the government and the government doesn't necessarily approve of both Coke or Pepsi or either, and the deputy SG resists that, says that this isn't really a limited public forum. It's really more about protections against would-be infringers rather than messages to consumers, and indeed the PTO spends resources on promoting and publishing all of these trademarks. So then Mr. Brunetti's lawyer comes in and leads with the two overall points that are the theme of his presentation. First, he points out that the government is not defending either the plain language of the statute prohibiting scandalous or immoral trademarks, or how it's been applied. So, in effect, the government is just saying, well, we understand, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, we're really going to limit this to obscenity or vulgarity or really, really bad stuff, not anything that has a viewpoint, you can trust us. And again, that harkens again to that exchange with Chief Justice Roberts from Citizens United. And secondly, a substantial number of people in America think that anything ranging from meat to abortion to guns to immigration are immoral. So if the test is, the subjective standard is something that significant populations or a substantial portion of the potential audience is scandalized, well, there's, you know, a lot of stuff that, forgetting viewpoint, would come into contact with this law. Again, Breyer then raises his, why don't we turn this into a physiological effect test? That is, most people can tell, you know, you don't necessarily need to hook somebody up and see when their blood rate elevates or what have you. But, quote, most people know what words we're talking about, as if that helps kind of putting in some sort of standard. But anyway, Justice Kagan then asked, well, what if the statute was more precise? What if it just said modes of speech? And it's at that point that Brunetti's counsel says, well, prohibiting obscenity is okay, because after all, obscenity is illegal. Same with fighting words, same with child pornography, right? All of these exceptions to the First Amendment, nobody's arguing that those things should be registered. He's just saying that the court should not create a further exception for the trademark context. Justice Alito asks then whether this really is the same as Cohen versus California, right? When the jacket worn into the courthouse with the evocative message, fuck the draft. Nobody is being punished here, right? Again, the government is not saying the brand FUCT can't go into the courtroom or anywhere else for that matter with its brand. The response to that, Brunetti's counsel is that there are some registered trademarks already that have some of the seven dirty words. F cancer, for example, he said, or F racism. Right? This goes further to the point, Alito says, that this has been applied inconsistently, but what about the statute itself? I think that ultimately, you know, that this facial versus as applied is really going to be an issue here. So, you know, again, will the justices narrow the statute to say, you know, to avoid constitutionally striking this down, we're going to interpret this to mean obscene, vulgar, non-viewpoint based, you know, just a mode of expression rather than conveying any sort of message. The Chief Justice pushes back on Brunetti's lawyer and says, well, you say that this isn't going to be on the main street or in Walmart, but what about people wearing your client's t-shirts at the mall? This, after all, trademark registration facilitates commercial speech. There'll be a non-marginal increase in exposure to these things if we allow this registration. And then Breyer continues, seems to be walking away from his own vote in Tam by saying that in Tam the word was used ironically. As you might recall, the Asian American rock band was taking back the slur, the Slants, by naming themselves after that. And again, the response to that is that racial slurs have been, in fact, registered since Tam. And Breyer says, well, yeah, but those kinds of slurs don't really raise the same physiological effect that some of the things that we're talking about here are. Justice Kavanaugh goes back to the bus advertising. And with respect specifically to words and letters, not obscene pictures, can any combination of words and letters be barred? At that point, Mr. Sommer, Brandy's counsel, says, well, you know, maybe a sentence or two, or you'd have to, you know, one word cannot really be obscene. You know, if you had a paragraph from the most lascivious literature or something that could be judged obscene somewhere, that would be a different thing, but that's not really what we're talking about here. Justice Gorsuch brought it back to the facial versus as applied, and what do we do? Justice Gorsuch asked, with the fact that this is a facial challenge, and the response is, well, simply that this restricts a substantial amount of speech. It's clearly overbroad, and in past overbroad cases, the court has told Congress to go back to the drawing board. It's at that point that the Chief Justice asks, well, can you trademark F-U-C-K? And there's kind of a complicated discussion there about, well, yes, if you use it commercially as your brand on the neck, which I guess is any IP lawyers on the line could explain to me the significance of being on the neck as part of your brand rather than something else, I guess, to convey a message. Mr. Sommer also reminds the court that the government doesn't dispute that here a viewpoint is indeed involved, one of rebellion or being edgy. As I mentioned in rebuttal then, Malcolm Stewart says that the PTO is waiting for the result of this case to see whether the N-word might be scandalous and reminds the court that content-based distinctions are often used in adjudicating trademarks, whether something is merely descriptive or generic or what the likelihood of confusion is. And in short, he says at the very end, this isn't about denying profanity a trademark because of the message that it sends, but because it's profanity. So, you know, you see how this you see how this all breaks down. How will the justices grapple with the idea of what is a message versus mere expression, utterance, profanity, vulgarity, what have you, and how do they handle the facial versus as applied, or kind of a very broad statute that at least lately seems to be applied more narrowly, although still inconsistently. So I don't think it's going to be a full win for either side here. I don't think it's going to simply be a clean reversal of the Federal Circuit saying, yeah, you can go back to what you've always been doing, and this is fully on the books, no interpretation, nor can I see happen what did in Tam, that is a wholesale striking down altogether. Curious in that way, because as I said, the expectation going in was that this would all be about, can you distinguish, how is this case different than Tam? And here you saw Breyer, at least, walking away from Tam in the first place, and others being skeptical that there was a viewpoint discrimination or a message being conveyed here. So I think I'll stop there. I'm happy to take or dodge any questions that might come on the line.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for the take on that, Ilya. Ilya, it does look like we do have two questions out of the gate, and I guess we'll go to our first caller.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Ilya, for a great presentation. I wanted to explore a little bit about the time, place, and manner restrictions and the outcome of this case. It seems to me that if you did, in fact, have a trademark, either for the slants or for the one that was at issue in this case, that lends a sort of imprimatur of the Patent and Trademark Office, so that you might be, have a leg up on any later Time, Mason, Planner, Manner restriction that you wanted to put that logo, on a city bus. I'm reminded, like all trial lawyers, of the great case of the Miracle on 34th Street, where Kris Kringle's identity was established because, of course, the post office delivered him mail in open court. And so, I'm making an analogy to the imprimatur of the Patent and Trademark Office. Don't you have a better than fighting chance, or at least better equities, if, the Trademark Office recognizes this? How could it be inappropriate speech for the 16 bus?
That's possible, but it really depends how the Supreme Court would write that opinion, because it could put in, and very well would, if that was the result, just a complete striking down of the restriction. It would say this does not mean in any way and should not be taken for any legal purpose that the government endorses or puts an imprimatur on this, or something in those words or not in so many words. I imagine there would be something like that, because there are all sorts of restrictions on speech that are time, place, and manner that we don't allow just vel non.
Thank
that's
you,
just
Colin.
My opinion. Who knows how they would actually do it, but that's my opinion. That's how I would do it.
Well, very good. We do have another question in the audience. Here's our second caller.
A couple of things made me wonder. And I wonder, why has everybody apparently conceded, according to your, telling, that this is not a viewpoint, or at least viewpoint-like discrimination? And as this case was coming up, so the one trademark that I was constantly thinking about that is registered and that is sort of popular is the FCUK, which apparently stands for French Connection United Kingdom.
Yep.
But it's obviously picked for a specific reason, not because it stands for French Connection United Kingdom, but because it looks like something entirely different. And so I just wonder where people sort of discussed why that one is in while FUCT is out, and how can the government sort of choose one versus the other. Because it's not clear to me that this is just content. It seems like, it's either viewpoint or it's just at least complete randomization of what's in and what's out.
I don't know if everyone's conceding that it's not. Well, in fact, Brunetti's lawyer is not saying that it's pure content, that there's no viewpoint. He's saying that this is a message of edginess and rebellion, and how it's used, the context is important. It's not just a matter of abstractly considering whether there's a message from a particular word. And indeed, if it's just a particular word and it's just generic and descriptive, that can't be trademarked for that reason. So I do think that the justices weren't necessarily, or certainly not a majority of them, were buying that FUCT or FCUK can be prohibiting it could be viewpoint discrimination. And FCUK did come up at a certain point. Yeah, because it's really no different than FUCT.
Well, thank you very much. We do have another caller in the audience with a question. Here's our third caller of the day.
Hi, Ilya. Cameron Atkinson. I had a quick question on judicial philosophy. What do you think the indication is for Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch to employ the constitutional and avoidance canon here?
Well, we'll have to see which opinion they join or write. You know, justices try out different things in oral argument. I certainly, you know, hesitate to predict results based on oral argument, let alone broader conclusions about judicial philosophy from individual justices based on their questions. You know, we'll see whether the fact that, you know, trademarks, after all, are positive rights. And at one point, I think Justice Alito mentioned that in a case last term, no, Justice Gorsuch, I think, mentioned that in a case last term, the court ruled that patents were public benefits rather than private rights. And so, trademarks, I guess, the court would see as the same thing, as a positive benefit, even if not necessarily agreeing with the government's formulation of this being a federal program. You know, their attitude towards public benefits are understandably different than natural rights or unenumerated rights or what have you. But I don't think this is the case where you're really going to be able to tease out doctrinal differences over, you know, broad philosophical things as between, you know, Gorsuch and Thomas and Roberts and Kavanaugh or what have you. Maybe, but it's kind of a weird case, you know, the interplay of intellectual property statute and First Amendment.
Thank you for your question, caller. Seeing no questions from the audience, and you still have a little bit of time if you'd like to ask one. Ilya, is there anything that you'd like to go into more detail or talk about from the case?
I don't think so. I mean, I gave a pretty complete play-by-play, I thought. Getting some feedback on Twitter and an email that maybe Roberts did not spell out F-U-C-K. Maybe I misheard or mentally interpolated his asking a previous time about the homonym on which F-U-C-T is based. So maybe I was wrong there, but that, I guess, goes to mental impressions and messages you convey in that way. But anyway, I will underline one more time the way that the government's lawyer, Malcolm Stewart, talked about the past participle of paradigmatic profanity. I mean, I think that's a statement that deserves to be remembered and evoked in all sorts of unrelated cases, kind of like nattering nabobs of negativity, these kinds of weird alliterative legal phrases. I appreciate that sort of thing.
Well, very good. Well, seeing no more audience questions, Ilya, we do want to thank you for joining us today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank you for the benefit of your very valuable time and expertise. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.